months to keep a state of peace in the middle of this tension. We hope this will expand and be transmitted to the so-called politicians in South Korea and the world, so that peace can be achieved politically.
We believe that, after all, politicians have some responsibility for the Korean Peninsula issue, but our citizens need to show some of the world's political leaders that the general public wants an end to the Korean War.
The Korean peace appeal seeks 100 million signatures to deliver to the United Nations and the warring parties next year. New South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is taking a hard line with North Korea, boosting the country's military and strengthening its alliance with the United States, with joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises planned for next month. Advocates for peace, like those gathered here today, have an uphill battle. Frank Smith, South Korea.
A gathering of Lebanese journalists and activists was held in the South Lebanon town of Naqoura to protest against Israel's extraction activities in the disputed waters.
We are so powerful, we can fight, we can go to war in case the enemy wants a war, unless we get our rights and our wealth in the sea and on the land.
Former head of the Lebanese negotiating team told Press TV that any negotiator should use all sources of power in his hands to strengthen their position facing the other party.
One of the strongest points is the resistance and the position of the resistance in the negotiation or for asking for getting what is right for Lebanon.
The speakers believe that Israeli attempts to drill in disputed waters could escalate the current status quo.
The Lebanese community and the media community is behind the Lebanese negotiation and behind the Lebanese resistance to confirm our right and in our wealth.
Within the presence of the resistance as well as the army of Lebanon and the people who refuse such aggression, because we believe that this act is already an aggression against Lebanon, and we have all the right to give a response to it, whether it is a legal response or any form of diplomatic or political or any form of response within our power of nation.
We came here, Lebanese government and people and press, to make the line and the point that this is our land and this is our sea and this is our sky.
Israeli caretaker Minister Yair Lapid has told U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein that he wants to make a deal with Lebanon over the disputed waters as soon as possible. This comes a week after Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said the resistance is ready for military escalation if Western pressure to prevent Lebanon from extracting its resources continues. Hochstein is expected in Beirut later in July.
We are here in Naqoura, the last Lebanese town on Lebanon's south coast. From here, at least three lines have been drawn in efforts to demarcate the maritime borders, all of which remain disputed, and nine both potentially rich in gas and petrol. But Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, says Western pressure has hampered extraction activities. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Verets, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old, and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist, after he was killed on the front line, the website posted. posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mira Tervets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Diana Spitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, is also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism.
They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. They basically, that's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. So, like the old saying is that the other one's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter. And hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
As the United Nations is pushing the warring sites in Yemen to renew the truce, the Sana'a government has set new conditions to accept the extension for a third period of 6 months. The head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, said the United Nations is now required to ensure the payment of all salaries which are suspended since 2016.
If the leadership in Sana'a accept the extension of the truce, the commitment under the agreement should be implemented from the first day of the truce. The blockade must be lifted by land, sea and air. All roads must be opened, and the salaries of Yemeni employees must be paid. The oil wells must be preserved, and the suffering of prisoners should be ended. Without this, the truce has no meaning.
Experts say it is likely that Sana'a rejects the terms of the current truce and pushes the United Nations to further ease the suffering of Yemenis by dispersing salaries.
It is clear from the political and military statements of Sana'a that they will not accept the request to extend the ceasefire easily. There are new demands by Sana'a to enter a third period of the agreement. The United Nations must fulfill previous commitments and deal with the new conditions positively. Otherwise, there will be a military escalation.
Yemen's demands come against the backdrop of United Nations' failure to force the Saudi-led coalition to fulfill its commitments under the current agreement that was brokered by the world body in early April.
Disappointing and useless, that's how Yemenis describe the current UN brokered agreement. They say the Yemeni army should be prepared for different scenarios, including military escalation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Due to their decision to sanction Russia over the unrest in Ukraine, France and the European Union are desperately trying to build energy stocks ahead of this winter. However, a record heat wave has created a surge in energy consumption, and that's prompted the government to informally call for the rationing of electricity. Citizens have been pushed to make an effort by cutting off Wi-Fi, unplugging appliances, and going without air conditioning. Many in poor neighborhoods say they expect their streets to go dark earlier and for their social services to be affected first. The West's sanctions campaign against Russia continues to force the average household into paying a steep price.
It's very difficult to see this crisis getting better by 2023. Finding alternative sources for gas and petrol will cause higher prices. Renewable energy will be more expensive. France isn't a big coal producer. France is already depleting its petrol and gas stocks. So every choice away from Russian energy is going to increase energy prices.
In order to have more control over the national energy grid, this week the government announced that they will totally renationalize the company Electricity of France. The energy giant runs all of the nation's nuclear power plants. Nuclear power provides nearly 70% of France's energy, the most of any country in the world. But a recent series of outages have caused nuclear power output to drop to its lowest level in nearly 30 years. Leaders of French energy corporations recently said that energy cuts are certain for this winter and that prolonged cold spells may threaten social and political cohesion.
The best solution is to negotiate with Russia to end the war in Ukraine. But we also need the leaders of the European Union to stop living in an isolated fishbowl where pushing for more war is a good idea. This energy and economic crisis is affecting all citizens.
A proposal to give the European Union the right to impose mandatory gas rationing across the bloc's 27 member countries was immediately shot down by the nations of Southern Europe this week. They called it the farthest-reaching power grab by Brussels this year. And it was especially controversial because individual national vetoes were not allowed under an emergency procedure employed by the leaders of the European Union. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., in a speech on Monday, 20th of June, former Vice President Mike Pence sounded like a future presidential candidate, but not like someone interested in discussing the specifics of 6th of January 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman and Reed Epstein. The piece is titled, Pence Navigates a Possible White House Run and a Fraught Political Moment. Former Vice President Mike Pence has emerged from the January 6 hearings in a peculiar position. To some Democrats in Congress, he has become something of a hero for resisting Donald J. Trump's pressure campaign to overturn the 2020 election at a time when American democracy seemed to teeter on the brink. To Donald Trump, however, and his political base, Mike Pence is a weakling who gave away the presidency. And to a swathe of anti-Trump voters in both political parties, he is merely someone who finally did the right thing by standing up to his former boss, years too late after willingly defending or ignoring some of Donald Trump's earlier excesses. The whipsaw of images creates an uncertain foundation for a potential presidential campaign, for which Mike Pence has been laying the groundwork. Yet the former vice president is continuing with his travels around the country in advance of the 2024 primaries, as he navigates his fraught positioning. Much as he did after the 2020 presidential election, when he tried to keep his tensions with Donald Trump from becoming public, only to have him push them into the light, Mr. Pence continues to walk a tightrope, trying to make the best of a situation he didn't seek without becoming openly adversarial to the president with whom he served and who remains the leader of the Republican Party. Mr. Pence himself has said little about 6th of January 2021, though his aides have testified about his resolve as Donald Trump and his allies tried to press him to subvert President Joe Biden's victory. On Monday, in an economic speech at the University Club of Chicago, Mike Pence sounded very much like a presidential candidate, but not much like someone interested in discussing the specifics of what he lived through on 6th of January 2021. "We've all been through a lot over the last several years," Mike Pence told the audience. "A global pandemic, social unrest, a divisive election, a tragic day in our nation's capital, and an administration seemingly every day driving our economy into the abyss of a socialist welfare state." Insights into Mr. Pence's mindset at the time have come largely from the testimony of his former chief of staff, Mark Short, and his former counsel, Greg Jacob. Mike Pence, as he made clear in his Chicago speech, has kept his sights trained on the Biden administration and on electing Republicans, including Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia and others, who were sharply at odds with Donald J. Trump in the midterm elections. If Mr. Pence has sharper things to say, he may not do so until the fall, when he has a book coming out. "The situation Mike Pence faces is a political briar patch," said David Kochel, a Republican strategist who worked on Jeb Bush's presidential campaign in 2016. "The more he's praised by Democrats and the media for doing the right thing on 6th of January 2021, the more some in Trump's base grow skeptical of his loyalty to the Trump team." He added, "There is no upside for him to lean into any of this." In Peoria, Illinois, Mike Pence called on Republicans to focus on the future and not the 2020 presidential election, an indirect reference to Donald Trump's incessant focus on his election loss that continues to this day. "In the days between now and Election Day, let's cast a positive vision for the future for the American people," Mike Pence told a crowd of Republican activists at a Lincoln Day dinner. "Yes, let's be the loyal opposition. Let's hold the other side accountable every single day. In the days between now and Election Day, we need you to say yes. Yes to the future. Yes to the future of freedom and our cherished values. And the Republican Party must be the party of the future." Three times, Mike Pence lauded accomplishments of the Trump-Pence administration. And he related a story from his high school reunion about a former classmate who encouraged him by telling him, "We need you guys back." During the speech, Kathy Sparrow, the chairwoman of the Republican Party of Hancock County, Illinois, shouted, "Pence for president." Mike Pence ignored the shout. "Trump had his turn," Kathy Sparrow said after Mike Pence's remarks. "It's now time for Pence to step up and run for president." The attention on Mike Pence provides both potential benefit and peril as he considers running for president. Payments from Democrats certainly do not help him, but his actions before, during and after January 6 give him an opportunity to differentiate himself in what could be a crowded primary field, one that may include Donald J. Trump. Mike Pence, whose support for Mr. Trump helped allay concerns about him from the evangelical voters in 2016, has the advantage of starting as a known entity to the Republican base. Mike Pence has tried to stake out a lane for himself by representing the aspects of the Trump White House that appeal to conservatives, but without the coarse and sometimes abusive behavior from Mr. Trump that they grew weary of. But this approach has been complicated by the fact that the loudest praise for Mike Pence has come from Democrats who voted to impeach Donald Trump. in a time of absolutely scandalous betrayal of people's oaths of office and crimes being committed all over the place, somebody who does their job and sticks to the law will stand out as a hero on that day. Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland and a member of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6 attacks, said on NBC News' Meet the Press program on Sunday. Jamie Raskin added, "And on that day, Mike Pence was a hero." Many other Democrats, however, have resisted the idea that Mr. Pence, who is known as cautious and loyal and who did not break with Donald Trump until the very end, should be praised, particularly as he considers campaigning to be the next president. Pence is currently on his own political rehab tour, hoping he can wash the stink of being Trump's vice president off, the Arizona Democratic Party said in a blast email when Mike Pence made the trip to the southern border in that state recently. But we know just because Mike Pence didn't give in on 6th of January 2021 doesn't change the fact that he missed multiple opportunities to do the right thing for four whole years. Other Democrats, including the members of the Democratic National Committee, have highlighted that Mike Pence adhered closely to Donald Trump without wavering during some of the biggest controversies of Trump's presidency, including his first impeachment, and that Mr. Pence did not speak publicly about his views until moments before the election certification began on 6th of January 2021. Nonetheless, even some of the harshest critics of the Trump era have said that the actions of 6th of January should not be treated lightly. It's true that for months before the election and weeks after, Mike Pence played along with Donald Trump's baseless election conspiracies, said David Axelrod, a former top advisor to former President Barack Obama. Axelrod added, "He certainly didn't dissent. But at the end of the day, he'll be remembered for one critical moment when he resisted enormous pressure and literally put his life on the line for our democracy. And for that, he deserves all the accolades that he's received." The complaints from Democrats have focused not just on Mike Pence's tolerance for Donald Trump's norm-shattering behavior, but also for the Trump administration's policies. Mr. Pence's aides say he believed the administration was enacting policies he generally agreed with, including putting forward conservative nominees for three Supreme Court seats. His long loyalty to Donald Trump could resonate with some Republicans, but with the former president demanding total fealty, it is a difficult line to walk. The irony is that Mike Pence was arguably the prime enabler of Donald Trump, said Rob Stutzman, a Republican strategist based in California. Stutzman added, "He was the mainstream traditional conservative Republican who would go to donors and not just defend Donald Trump and his policies, but with a straight face, insist that Donald J. Trump was a good man." Mr. Short, Mike Pence's former chief of staff, has been critical of aspects of the House committee's work at a time when Donald Trump has encouraged his supporters to view the panel as illegitimate. That has allowed Mike Pence to keep some distance from the work of the committee, which he has not appeared before himself. Officials are expected to try again to ask Mike Pence to testify, a move he will most likely resist. On Sunday, Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat of California and a member of the House committee, left open the idea that requesting his presence may still happen. "Certainly a possibility," Adam Schiff said. "We're not excluding anyone or anything at this point."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Wei. Iran and the IAEA are having a difference of opinion episode again. Iran is slammed as unfair and unprofessional. The recent remarks by the IAEA Director General about the agency's limited visibility on Iran's nuclear activities. It was also in response to how Rafael Grossi has said that Iran's nuclear program is, quote, galloping ahead. In this edition of the program, we will look at Iran's nuclear file, why the IAEA repeats a now familiar scenario of raising the alarm on Iran's civilian nuclear program, and whether there are foreign hands at play, especially from the nuclear-powered Israeli regime. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. John Bustos joins us. He's a journalist, activist, and political analyst who joins us from Belgrade. Also joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Marseille, France.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me start with you, John Busnich. I'm looking down what the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has said, that Iran will not act hastily and emotionally to this nuclear deal revival talks. That's a pretty charged statement coming from the Iranian Foreign Ministry. What is he trying to say there?
Well,
I think we've all been able to see, no matter where you are in the world, that Iran is being given a hurdle to go over that is continuously being raised. No matter what Iran does to comply with the conditions set down by the IAEA and any other monitoring that Iran has conducted on its own, including the live cameras, it's not enough. And that suggests an ulterior motive on the part of those who are complaining against Iran. That's the clearest message we've got from all of this.
Well, this is what Elijah Magna Iran has said. We're definitely thinking about an agreement, and we are interested in its conclusion, but we will not act emotionally that the finalization of the accord hinges upon a political decision by the United States. We're getting that response from Iran, which the ending part of that statement is what the U.S. has said about Iran, that a political decision by Iran needs to be made. What do you make of it?
Well,
this is for Elijah Magner. I'm sorry, John Busnish. Go ahead, Elijah.
No problem.
Thank you for having me. I think Iran has never acted emotionally, particularly in the last decade, when dealing with the Americans by asking a signature of a document that is JCPOA, where trust was unexisting between America, the West, and Iran on both sides. Because of that, Iran is not in a hurry today to sign any deal, but needs to sign a deal that is at least ensuring that in the next 2 years that remaining of Biden's administration life, the president is going to respect his signature and is going to respect the deal. This is why Iran is saying, if I don't have all the confirmation that I need, I am not in a hurry. Why Iran should be in a hurry? Because Iran is producing 60% enriched uranium. Its advanced technology has acquired for its scientists all the knowledge needed to reach 90% enriched uranium and to increase the level of technology and the advanced centrifuge. Therefore, Iran is in a position of strength. The West is saying we don't want Iran to produce a nuclear bomb, and Iran is saying, I am not producing nuclear bomb. So if you want the assurance, you sign a deal and you lift all the sanctions. If the West is not willing to lift the sanction, why should Iran offer anything for free to the Americans and the Europeans, who both never respected their end of the bargain, even after the signature of the JCPOA in 2015, including Barack Obama and all the European company that withdrew from Iran after 2018 when President Donald Trump took the U.S. out of the deal. So by saying we're not acting out of emotion and confirming that Iran is going to act only on black and white, if there is a signature with the lifting of the IRGC from the list of terrorism, with the lifting of all sanctions, there are more than 3,500 sanctions on Iran. If the Americans are not willing to do so, well, why the Americans don't consider the JCPOA dead, and then the relationship will return between Iran and the rest of the Western countries, including the Europeans and the Americans, and life continue as it was before 1979. But the West is insisting and linking the JCPOA to the lifting of sanctions, and Iran comply by the JCPOA. It is the American that withdrew and the European that did not respect the end of the bargain. It is up to them to demonstrate that they have a goodwill, sign a document, and Iran is ready to do so. But we hear that the Americans are looking only for oil and looking only for energy to relieve the sanction that they have imposed on Russia. Iran has gas and oil that can sell to the world, but the Americans are still very stubbornly insisting on not lifting the sanctions.
Well, this is the problem, one of them. There's so many of them, John Busnish, but this is one of the things where you have, and I asked Elijah that too, and I'm going to ask you, where the U.S. says that Iran says that the U.S. is making excessive demands. Meanwhile, Iran says, or the West says that Iran is the one making the excessive demands. So one avenue or channel to look at would be the U.S. Special Envoy Robert Malley, where he says Tehran had not made the fundamental decision, quote, as to whether they want to renew the deal. And then in Doha, Malley said that Iran had added new demands, but then it didn't give any details. Why wouldn't he give details? Why wouldn't he say these are the demands? Well, because somewhere when you make that statement, then you have to add what those demands are. I mean, that's a natural question. Why isn't the U.S. disclosing it?
Well, you put your finger right on the point there. The fact is that Iran is not making any additional demands. Iran is simply asking for the United States to honor a contract that it signed. The agreement on the JCPOA was a bilateral agreement with securities from European countries. United States officials and the president himself canceled the agreement with no compensation to Iran. And yet they still expect Iran to abide by a non-existing agreement that the United States canceled. Anybody who's taken their first class in basic law knows that a contract canceled by one party is no longer binding on the other party. And this is where politics and the law meet each other face to face, and America finds itself in complete contradiction. It says one thing and does another. We should stop referring to USA as the United States of America. We should just call them the United Sanctions of America, because they're sanctioning everybody.
Yeah, sanctions is another thing we're going to talk about. So, Elijah Magnier, let's get down to some dates, because there have been so many dates given that it's noteworthy to talk about it. And I'm going to start with this U.S. Special Envoy, Robert Malley. July 5th. Iran, a matter of weeks from having enough for a bomb, it would be something we would know and we would react quite forcefully. Obviously, a few weeks has gone by. Rafael Grossi, June 9th, Iran, weeks away. Benny Gantz, I'm not too sure what position he has in Israel right now. I'm not even too sure if there's a functioning cabinet there as to how that regime is running matters or affairs. But Benny Gantz said, Iran, weeks from enough fissile material for a bomb. And this false danger has been announced time and again, and that timeline has finished. Why are there such timelines given unless they are trying to force Iran into signing something that they have that Iran does not see worth signing at this point? I'm guessing again here.
I think it's an ignorance from the side of the West to have to deal with Iran, because we've heard this since Benjamin Netanyahu showing that Iran is very close to produce a nuclear bomb. And then everybody in the U.S. administration since Donald Trump and Joe Biden now is saying Iran is a week away from producing the nuclear bomb. So this is a very usual rhetoric that is becoming extremely boring and is no longer sellable anywhere. Saying that has only an objective. The West is trying to put pressure on the world, saying that Iran is very close to have its nuclear bomb and must act swiftly and quickly. So the West is in a dilemma. First of all, Iran showed its capability to defend itself with the missiles and the precision missile that was able to hit the Mossad base in Iraq, Daesh during the war against Daesh in Syria, and in different places, including supporting its allies with a drone. And now Russia is also asking for a drone. So all that is giving Iran a strong capability and the capability to challenge even the superpower when Iran bombed Ain al-Assad, the U.S. military base in Iraq. Secondly, Iran is saying, I have very clear requests. You lift all the sanctions and the JCPOA will be back on track. By saying the JCPOA is almost dead and the chances are very slim or almost none, and we are only 2 weeks away from losing all the possibility to sign the JCPOA again, or Iran is only a couple of weeks away from making a nuclear bomb, all these excuses are no longer valid because the Americans are no longer going to go to war against Iran. The Israelis can't go on their own. They need the Americans with them. And the Americans have 35 military bases around the Middle East that present themselves as a perfect target to the Iranian missiles. So all this word is only to say we're still in the game and we would like Iran to come forward. They're trying to put psychological pressure on Iran that doesn't work. It didn't work in the past. It is not going to work. I remember when Donald Trump said he's sitting by the phone waiting for the Iranian call that never came. So all that shows a very high ignorance of the West and the Iranian mentality that the request of Iran is very clear. Lift all the sanctions and have a signature on the JCPOA. You don't lift the sanctions, we continue in our program. As simple as that.
So we're making all these different viewpoints on the matter, John Busnich. At the same time, both are showing some eagerness in order for this to get wrapped up. But, of course, it has not. Now, the U.S. President Joe Biden came to the region. He went to Israel, and Israel obviously continued with pushing the U.S. not to go ahead and even wanted to enforce, as it has been, the thought of military confrontation with Iran, in which Joe Biden said, you know, we're going to opt for the diplomatic route through the JCPOA revival talks, even though at the end said if that doesn't work out, then the use of force is not out of the question. Now, Iran has said if America looked at the matter through the prism of America's national interests, not the Zionist regime, then the ground is paved for an agreement. Do you think it's Israel that's preventing the U.S., especially given the fact that you have the midterms coming up and Biden wants to use Israel in order to make sure that that goes well for him?
You're absolutely right again, and this is the same theme over and over again. The United States has one rule for Israel and a different rule for others. And that is a direct result of the fact that the Israel lobby in the United States is the single largest donor to both political parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. You know, we have the case in history about the Israeli nuclear bomb, which is still not recognized by the United States, despite the fact that they know of it. Mordecai Vanunu, the Israeli whistleblower who exposed the Israeli nuclear weapons program, not a nuclear a power program, but a nuclear weapons program, has been jailed for 18 years and is now still not allowed to have any contact with any foreigners. Silence is golden when it comes to Israel, but all the United States does is talk about everybody else. And they've been talking, as you've mentioned, about the Iranian nuclear program having enough material for a bomb several weeks from now. And they've been saying that far more than several months. They've been saying that since before last year, if you cover the media coverage in the United States. Basically, what the United States position on this, the United States government position under the pressure of Israel, is to treat the public like a donkey, talking about a two-week deadline forever, just like the old drawing of a mule or a donkey that'll walk forever if you just hang a carrot on a stick over its head. That's how they treat the public. They think we're as stupid as donkeys, but we're not. And it's not just Iranians who know this. It's people all around the world and a growing number of Americans as well.
Elijah Magnier, the way that Iran has talked about Israel's nuclear arsenal is one reason why it's really hard to then see how the IAEA takes Israel's disinformation and dishes it out as if that is fact-based. Doesn't that make for a ridiculous scenario where you have, as Ivana says, a regime that's not under the IAEA supervision and not a member of the NPT?
Well, the whole world is closing both eyes on the nuclear capability of Israel and the perhaps 100 to 200 nuclear bombs that Israel has, with information coming out recently that Israel was about to use the nuclear bomb in the 7 days war against the Arabs. So what you just said confirmed again when Rafael Grossi went to Israel And the prime minister, well, now he's a former prime minister, Bennett said that Rossi is my friend. And the exchange of information between Israel and the IAEA is not new. However, if we look at the information that comes from Israel, regardless of what Iran thinks or defend itself by saying this is a misinformation, all the information that the Israelis have provided the world with were fake and inaccurate. So everything that the IAEA is doing, it is part of the Western infrastructure and component that needs to fit with the narrative of what the US wants. So if the IAEA is responding to what the Israelis want, it's because the Americans have this will for the IAEA to listen to what the Israelis are saying and to repeat that when they come to Iran. So I think Iran, by removing the 27 cameras, is showing its determination that it's not playing around and it doesn't care about what the IAEA is saying without solid proof, by giving only an intelligence information that cannot be proof. We all know what intelligence information is, particularly when the Americans are coming out and saying, we provide intelligence information that are not confirmed and not corroborated, and they can be fake. So all that is part of the propaganda that Iran is not taking on board. This is why the foreign minister, Abdullahian, is saying, we are serious, we're not going to behave according to our feelings and emotions, but according to black and white. This is what we want, this is what you need to give us. What comes from Israel, Israel has been saying that it wants to attack Iran and is not capable of doing so. Israel is saying that Iran is very close to a bomb. According to the Israeli, in 2016, Iran should have had the nuclear bomb already. So all this fake, inaccurate information is a kind of propaganda just to mount the pressure on Iran. But Iran is not affected by that, and observers around the world are very much aware that Iran is not going toward the nuclear weapons because it has the capability to increase the enriched uranium from 60 to 90%. That is, according to scientists, is the easiest passage. It is the will to create a nuclear bomb is lacking because Iran doesn't want it.
Well, you mentioned, I think, or both of you maybe have mentioned, but I know you just mentioned about these cameras, of which now that's making the rounds and the headlines again, John Basnish. And we need to discuss that because when the cameras have come on as a headline, Iran has said they're going to remain turned off until the 2015 nuclear deal is revived. And it says, listen, the cameras were on. We were getting these accusations that Iran is continuing its path on weaponizing its nuclear program. And it says, why should we sit back, receive these accusations, and have the cameras stay on? They're going to stay off. You had a JCPOA deal that made sure that everything was fine. The U.S. opted to come out of that, and the whole thing unraveled. So Iran's response is that. Why is the camera thing then becoming a headline? I mean, are they trying to again make this a big deal to show that Iran is non-compliant?
Well, as a journalist, I can tell you the news cycle is driven by the most scandalous and most eye-opening headline that you can put up. And of course, since Iran has been demonized in the Western media for years, because in effect the Iranian people chose to have the government that they wanted in power, not what the Western powers wanted in power, they have set the basic foundations for continual lying against Iran. And it is not just starting this year or last year, or it's been going on for decades. And we now are sitting in a situation where the public is expecting Iran, Western public at least, is expecting Iran to do something evil, to do something unfair, and therefore they've created a narrative in which you can throw in any new data and the public just blindly believes it. And I have to say that Israel and America together are producing this result, and it's a terrible thing that Israel and America together are trying to prove that Joseph Goebbels' Nazi saying that repeating a lie 1,000 times creates the truth is actually true.
Okay.
This is what they're doing.
Well, last question goes to you, Elijah Magnier. The most recent trip by Joe Biden to the region really didn't produce the results that he wanted, did it? And I want you to put that in a regional context for us, where you have regional countries, when it comes to Iran, of which they're receiving Iran. Iran has extended itself to enhance its relations. Saudi Arabia, it's in talks with. We don't know how that's going, but there are positive signals coming out of that. And the rest of the neighbors, Iran is getting close to them, enhancing itself, signing MOUs. Regionally speaking, everybody seems to be okay with Iran at this point based on what we're seeing. So doesn't that leave the U.S. and Israel out in the cold, whom are, especially Israel, sounding the alarm of, we'll use force if necessary, and, you know, that military-type rhetoric, which obviously doesn't sit well with too many of Iran's neighbors?
Indeed. Joe Biden returned to Washington from Saudi Arabia almost empty-handed, but for from a few extra barrel of oil from the Saudis, who said they will accommodate his request in July and August only with 13.5 million barrels a day. But what the Saudis said clearly is that we want a peace with our neighbors. We want to talk to Iran. Iran is no longer demonized as used to be in the past. And the Saudis and the Iranians are going to meet soon in Iraq on the level of both foreign ministers. It was a very clear message from the Saudis. It's a very clear message from the Qataris saying the Palestinian cause is on top of the agenda,
okay,
when Biden disregarded that cause. So the message from the Saudis came that the countries of the region are capable of sorting out their problems without the help or the support of the U.S., because the West has never been supportive. On the contrary, the aim of the West,
sure,
was only to sell weapons to the Middle Eastern countries and to demonize Iran, to create an enemy so they can rely on the support of the U.S. always.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, and John Busnish, thank you for your contribution, journalist, activist, and political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitagway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This